Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by listeners like you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Somerset County Tourism. Hear stories from local brewers and distillers from the New Jersey Sip and See Trail on episode 647 of Beer Sessions Radio, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And you know, whenever there's a question about a food industry policy, and this has been history for maybe almost 50 years, no less than that, but whenever there's been a question about food industry policy or a nutrition advisory, reporters know exactly who to call and who will give them a straight answer. And that's Marion Nessel, the courageous champion of healthy food, social justice, and scientific integrity, as she's been called by Fast Food Nation author Eric Schlosser. But it was often a bumpy road in the beginning with a lot of detours to get to where she is today. Marion Nessel is a Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health Emerita at New York University in the department she chaired from 1988 to 2003 and from which she retired in September 2017. She is also a visiting professor of nutritional sciences at Cornell. She earned a PhD in molecular biology and an MPH, Master's of Public Health, in public health nutrition from the University of California, Berkeley. Previous faculty positions were at Brandeis University and the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine. From 1986 to 1988, she was Senior Nutrition Policy Advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and the editor of the 1988 Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health. Her research and writing examine scientific and socioeconomic influences on food choice and its consequences, emphasizing the role of food industry marketing. And I welcome you, Marion, to the show. And what I also wanted to mention were that books, I'm not going to read through the whole list of books, but I think everyone is familiar with your seminal work of 2002, Food Politics, which, without insult, I have to say, kind of put you on the map, even though amongst other people, you were already there. And you have been named the University of California School of Public Health at Berkeley named you as a public health hero. Kind of cool. And you have so many other accolades and awards. You have to read the book to find out, folks. Okay, but it's my pleasure to have you here today because this book is just a real treasure. And as you've been called, you have been called a national treasure. You help protect us when protection is definitely needed from food industry. We talk about big pharma all the time, but we don't talk about big food industry all the time, and we should. And this book, as I say, it was a bumpy road. It really struck a chord with me. Because at a certain age, I there was so much I could identify with, you know, kids at home not being taken seriously, equal pay, women's rights, the whole ball of wax. But so you tell me a little bit about your beginnings without going through the whole book, but how you remained so persistent.
Well, hi, Linda. Thanks for asking. I'm not sure. I think it was in my character to try to make the best of whatever situation I was in. You don't get to choose your family, mm-hmm. and mine was difficult for me for lots of reasons that I talk about in the book. And I just tried to do the best I could with what I was confronted with. I was very much a child of my time. I was born in the Depression to a very poor family. I grew up at a time when options for women were very limited. You were expected to get married and have children, and that was your goal in life. And as I mentioned in the book, my three closest friends in high school had as their lifetime goals to marry a professor, a doctor, and a rabbi, respectively, and they did. It still seems amazing to me. I didn't even have those goals. The expectations for women were extremely low. I tried to do what I could within those strictures and didn't succeed very well for a very long time, hence the title, Slow Cooked.
Right. Well, I wondered how that, what that came about until I started reading the book, and then I got it. You wrote, here you got your PhD in molecular biology, and your path was going in a couple of different directions, but you wrote that preparing the course in nutrition for the first time was like falling in love. Can you expand on that a little bit? Right before you wrote the book, the notes became the book, Nutrition in Clinical Practice.
No, it was quite a bit before then. I was teaching at Brandeis University in the biology department, and the course I was teaching was cell and molecular biology, which I enjoyed teaching a lot. It's really interesting stuff. It's what life is about. But for students, it was extremely abstract and difficult. And my department had very unusual rules. One was that you could only teach the same course three times in a row, and then you had to change in order to keep it fresh. And another one was that you had to teach whatever the department needed, whether you knew anything about it or not, because you had a doctorate and you should be able to learn anything better than freshmen and sophomore students could. And the students in the biology department were complaining that they weren't getting any human biology. They wanted human biology courses. And so the department offered me at the end of my third semester of teaching cell and molecular biology, they offered me either physiology or nutrition. And I picked nutrition. And I picked nutrition because I was kind of curious about it. Linus Pauling had just written Vitamin C in the Common Cold. Francis Moore Lappe had just come out with Diet for a Small Planet. The Center for Science and the Public Interest had just been founded and published a book called Food for People, Not for Profit. All of these things were books that I could use in that course, and they were really interesting. And I thought, well, this will be the way that I'll teach undergraduate biology to students because they would be able to understand the studies in exactly the same way that I found the studies easy to understand. And the studies were amazing. Hmm. Unlike molecular biology, the studies were done on a small number of subjects, weren't very well controlled. I tell this story about how I went to read about how the recommended dietary allowance for vitamin C was established. And one of the studies was done on 8 male prisoners in a penitentiary in Kansas or some Midwestern state. And during the study, 2 of the prisoners escaped. This was not a well-controlled clinical trial.
We're down to 6 guys now.
Yeah, we're down to 6. This is really fun. Students who were having so much, who could not possibly read original research papers in Cell or the Journal of Biological Chemistry, could read these studies and see immediately what was wrong with them and criticize them and do real critical thinking in biology. And I had 50 students in my first class, and they were fantastic. They were really excited about it. and really wanted to read all this stuff. And in those days, students could read original research papers and write papers about them. And it was fabulous to teach them. And then in about 20 of them wanted a second semester because they liked it so much. And so I had two semesters in which students taught me what I needed to know about nutrition, really. And then I went on from that. That was the last time I taught undergraduates for a long time because I went on to teach at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, UCSF mm-hmm. School of Medicine in San Francisco, and taught nutrition to medical students for the next 8 years. So, you know, one thing led to another in those days.
Well, and then you wrote your first book, Nutrition, as I mentioned, Nutrition in Clinical Practice. And that was during the time you were teaching, or just when you after you finished teaching the medical students, I presume. I'm forgetting the details from the book, but
yeah, I was teaching medical students, and it was clear that medical students didn't get very much nutrition education. So I wrote a book for health practitioner students, medical students, nursing students, pharmacy students who didn't have nutrition classes, which meant all of them, really, and sort of summarized everything that I thought was important about clinical nutrition in one small volume. And I have to say something about that volume because it's long out of print and long out of date. It went out of print because the publisher gave up his publishing business and went to music school. but it's also pretty much out of date. But I saw a copy of it on Amazon advertised last year where you could buy a copy of this little paper-bound book that was printed in 1985 for $930. I couldn't believe it. And I couldn't believe that anybody would spend that kind of money for a book that was so out of date.
I think somebody must have Googled you
and then got that up. Yeah. Anyway, the book's no longer there. Does that mean that somebody bought it? I can't believe that.
Yeah. Well, this I forgot. Well, first of all, I wanted to say that in your comments about nutrition and loving it so much when you had been on a different path, although you had talked about loving to cook and learning to cook and spent your time, you know, when you were at home with the kids in between school, cooking and learning to cook. So it's no, I guess, surprise that your memoir, which I didn't read the whole title, the memoir is Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics. I mean, people get this if they saw the beginning of the show. Did this course in nutrition and your love of it, did it sort of set the course for you?
Oh, it absolutely did. Because I had the students write papers about some aspect of the diet and health, vitamin C in the common cold, fat and heart disease, fiber and cancer, I mean, anything that they were interested in. And they, you know, I had 50 papers that first semester, and they were all the same. They all said the studies were used too few subjects. They weren't well controlled. The prisoners escaped. The assays weren't good. There was this problem and this problem and this problem. And they concluded at the end that it was really impossible to draw firm conclusions from any of the things they had studied about. And they were studying maybe 30 different things. There were some duplications. And that really framed the way I thought about nutrition from then on. I've never looked back.
Yeah.
Nothing that happened after that has changed my view of that. This was real critical thinking in nutrition. It taught me how to criticize the publications. It taught me, first of all, it taught me what was really critically important about understanding why nutrition research is so difficult, which is it's really hard to find out what people eat.
Yeah.
It's really hard to make overall comments or generalizations about people's eating, because diets change so much from day to day and differ so much from individual to individual that it's really, really difficult to do this kind of research. I think it's the most intellectually challenging question in the field of nutrition is, what do people eat? And if you don't know what people are eating, it's very hard to say whether what they're eating is affecting their diets or their health in any way, in any particular way. No wonder the studies are so conflicted and so complicated and so subject to interpretation. Right. It's because the basics are so hard to do. And that's a problem that we've not yet solved, except in controlled clinical trials done in metabolic wards, where the diets are controlled, and those studies can only be short-term, but it's why they're so important.
Right. Well, it's interesting because you resisted getting your master's in public health initially, but then you wrote that you realized that it's about how social and political forces determine the health risks of populations, which, and then you're talking about, well, you got to know what they're eating, right? So then you went and you got you went to the School of Public Health and got your master's there after you had your doctorate in molecular biology. But public health, did that really, did you think that was a career changer in a sense?
Well, I'd always been interested in public health. It was one of those, I had taken a course, an undergraduate course in public health when I was a sophomore, and it was a course that was so easy for me that I just didn't think it was worth studying. I mean, I had this weird idea that if a subject was easy, it was because it wasn't worth studying. It never occurred to me that it was easy for me because I think like a public health person and that it was a really, really good fit for my interests. And so coming back to public health school was a really good fit for my interests. I resisted going for that reason, and also because I already had a doctorate. I didn't think I needed a master's degree.
Right.
It turned out to be enormously useful in coalescing my thinking, in bringing the way I thought about public health nutrition to the surface, in bringing a lot of things together that I was looking at sort of separately and really needed to have brought together so that I had a unified worldview. Plus, it offered me fantastic opportunities. My field work during the year I spent in public health school was with the Coalition of Homeless Shelter Providers in San Francisco, which was an education in itself. You can't pay for an education like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I really learned what it was like to deal with on a day-to-day basis people who are, as we now call them, unhoused, and why they're unhoused and why they want to be unhoused rather than being put into shelters, and the kinds of things that they're interested in and what their needs are, particularly the needs of single mothers who had children in a hotel for single mothers. I mean, it was just an eye-opening experience and a real revelation to me about what an enormous problem this was. And this was right at the beginning of the homeless problem. It was in the early 1980s. And then, so that was fantastic. And then I was given this unbelievable opportunity to go to Southeast Asia for the Agency for International Development to do my block public health field work in Southeast Asia. It was the first time I'd traveled by myself. It was the first time I'd been to Asia. It was the first time I'd ever gone to countries where not only could I not speak the language, I couldn't read the language and understand the street signs. So that, too, was a phenomenal experience in trying to make something like that work. I mean, I explain my character as trying to make work the situation that I'm put in. And that those were difficult situations with real barriers and problems that had to be overcome that somehow I was able to make work. And I look back on as just fantastic experiences that, you know, as I say, you couldn't pay to do something like that. So I think public health is, you know, a wonderful thing to do. I encourage everybody to go to public health school.
Well, I mean, and going to Asia, like, you never know where it's going to lead and what you're going to come out with. I mean, that was pretty phenomenal at the time. But was it during this time? I mean, when did you first realize that foods rather than nutrients were the important focus? We had talked, you know, the talk was all about nutrition, nutrients, and how much of this and that you need, but you realized that it was the actual foods that were important.
Well, I think the turning point, and I write about this in the book, the turning point was a conference that I went to on cigarette smoking that was held at the National Cancer Institute in the early 1990s. I was already at NYU by then. And, you know, continuing to write about aspects of nutrition and health and so forth. But at this conference, I heard a group of international physicians and scientists who were anti-smoking advocates show slide presentations of cigarette marketing. And they showed presentations of cigarette marketing in remote areas of the world, in developing countries, the jungles of Africa, the high Himalayas. There was one presentation on marketing cigarettes to children that was slide after slide after slide of the Joe Camel character and other ways in which cigarette companies were trying to reach children. And I knew that cigarette companies marketed, and I knew that cigarette companies marketed to children, but I had never paid any attention to it. I had never seen the marketing presented as one example after another, after another, after another, after another, so that at the end of it, you realize how systematic this is. And I walked out of those presentations thinking, we should be doing this for Coca-Cola. We nutritionists should be looking at the way in which companies that are selling products that are not particularly good for us are doing that in a systematic way. And so I started paying attention.
And
I started paying
right.
attention. Every place I went, I started paying attention to the ways in which food companies were marketing, particularly marketing to children, and started writing articles about it. And I wrote those articles over the next 5, 6, 7, or 8 years. And when the time came when I finally realized that, unlike molecular biology, which values research articles and doesn't care about books at all, NYU valued books. And that we now had food studies. Food studies was a humanities field. Humanities fields value books. It was time for me to write a book. And those, I thought, well, I can take those articles and put them together, one example after another. And that was the genesis of Food Politics, which came out in 2002 and then subsequently in 2 later editions, 5 and 10 years later.
Yeah. I mean, we are so, you know, I guess, inured by the constant billboards and ads and TV commercials and whatever else that, you know, we don't really stop and think about what are they saying? What are they putting in front of us? I remember taking a course that was on feminism and marketing and some of the outrageous things that were being, you know, marketed with all these sort of subconscious little themes going through them that, you know, unless you stop and really look at it and think about it, you don't know what they're, you know, what are they trying to tell us? Who are they trying to get to, you know? And
well, you're
same thing with the
to,
food, right?
Yeah, you're not supposed to think about them. Mm-hmm. The way it's been explained to me is that if marketing is done well, you don't notice it. Or, as they put it, it slips below the radar of critical thinking. You absorb it at an unconscious level without really paying attention to it. They don't want you to pay attention to it. Because
right.
if you paid attention to it, you would know that you were being marketed to and could resist it. So that was what I did. I just started paying attention. And I had some goals in writing Food Politics. I never, never, never wanted to go to another conference about childhood obesity and hear people talk about how are we going to get mothers to feed their children more healthfully?
Yeah.
I never wanted to hear that again. what I wanted to hear was everybody at those conferences saying, how are we going to get the food industry to stop marketing junk foods to our kids? How are we going to do that? That should be our goal, not how we educate mothers about making healthier food choices, but instead changing policy so we stop food companies from marketing to our children.
Right, right. Well, advocacy is something that I think has always been in your blood from reading your memoir of your early childhood. I think that's always been there, and fortunately, you've put it to good use, which I thank you for. I want to talk about a little bit more about food systems when we come back after a really short break. So put that in your head, and we'll talk about that when we come back.
I'm Jimmy Carboni, host of Beer Sessions Radio on HRN. I recently hosted a live podcasting event with local beer and spirits makers from beautiful Somerset County, New Jersey. We spoke on the farm that is home to Flounder Brewery and Belmar Distillery, one of the most beautiful stops along the Sip and See craft beverage trail.
To me, those two worlds, brewery and distillery, are extremely complementing businesses, especially in a unique location like this. So it immediately helped this become a destination to have a great experience, whether it's the beer atmosphere we've got going in here in the old barns or the great experience you can have in there with these incredible cocktails that are created there. It's complementary to each other. You can have two completely different experiences all within a 10-foot walk from each other.
Before the event, I was able to tour the area and see the historic Bridge Tender's House along the serene DNR Canal, walk the bike and hiking trails, and take in the lush farmland. Then we settled into the centuries-old Dutch barn turned brewery for a lively discussion.
It was always important for us to create our space, our livelihood that we want to share with everybody else, of being a community-centric location. It is what makes us a brewery in this state different from a barn or restaurant. We're obviously family-friendly here. We have a lot of different groups that have their meetings here during the week. We just really want to become a community hub.
You can listen to this episode of Beer Sessions Radio, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again to Somerset County Tourism for supporting this episode. Learn more about the Sip and See Passport Program at visitsomersetnj.org. That's visit SOMERSETNJ.org.
And we're back, and I'm talking with Marion Nessel, and she has just written her memoir. It's just come out, and it's on the bookshelves. It's called Slow Cooked, an Unexpected Life in Food Politics. And Marion, there's a term that you said, well, if we're going to be taken seriously, and well, back up and say about seriously, the study of food in any way, shape, or form was never admired or respected by academia. If somebody wanted to study food history, food, the background of food in people's social lives, in how communities were formed, it wasn't really scholarly, and no attention would be given to it. You managed to buck the system all along the way and have brought good scholarly and academic attention to food studies. And you talked about the term food systems. I guess in getting it to be taken seriously, because there were so many different systems and studies groups, but when you talk about food systems, talk a little bit about exactly what you mean by that term.
Sure, but let me just say something about food studies first, which is that when we started our food studies program at NYU, the first question I got asked was, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
And why would you want to study about food? And there was, there was a gastronomy program at Boston University at the time, and which still exists. I didn't think gastronomy would work at NYU, but lots of academic programs end with the word studies, French studies, Africana studies, science studies, and I thought food studies would work, and it has. And in a sense, we made the field academically responsible, because there are probably 60 or 70 universities in the United States that teach food studies in one form or another, and practically every department now has a food course in it.
It is amazing. I'm shocked every time I go and look at someone's application for something, and they see where they come from. They're in the food studies department, and they'll name this university, in the middle of nowhere. I'm saying, what? Wow, when did all that happen?
Well, it happened within the last 25 years. We know exactly right. When it happened. And it's really gratifying to me, because I think it's a great way to teach anything. Food systems is a relatively new term. It's something that's only been used frequently within the last 5 or 10 years. And it refers to everything that happens to a food from the time that it's produced until the time it's consumed and wasted. And what it means is that you can't really understand why people eat the way they do unless you understand the way food is produced. You can't really understand what the problems of hunger, malnutrition, food insecurity, obesity, obesity-related chronic diseases, resistance to COVID-19, and those kinds of problems, unless you understand the way the food system works. And we saw that beautifully illustrated during the COVID-19 pandemic, which, if it did any good at all, was to highlight how the food system works and how important the low-wage workers are in agriculture, in meatpacking plants, in grocery stores, in grocery delivery systems. I mean, that people were really not aware of food supply chains or how the whole low-wage system functions, or the fact that, farm workers don't have the same kind of labor rules and regulations that other kinds of workers have. All of those things became apparent because people were forced to look at food systems because they were failing during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Right.
So this is the big thing that everybody's teaching now. There are two other things that I think are really new in the whole food area. One of them is what's called triple duty dietary advising, which is to recommend a diet that is appropriate for reducing hunger, reducing chronic disease, and reducing climate change all at the same time. And these are diets that include less meat than we typically consume in the United States and more vegetables than are typically consumed. And then the third is the whole business about ultra-processed foods, a specific category of processed foods that are industrially produced, can't be made in home kitchens, don't look anything like the foods they came from, and that are very, very strongly associated with chronic disease risk, and are the kinds of foods that everybody should be eating less of. So these are kind of new concepts in food and nutrition these days, and that's what I'm teaching.
Well, I think that's tremendous. I mean, yes, you say you retired in 2017, but I know you're still there. I know you're still teaching.
Right. Yeah. Still giving lectures, still sparring off.
Right.
Still ranting.
You're not still in your office, are you?
Yes, I've kept my office.
Well, I know I walked in one time after you had retired, and I said, "Wait a minute, you're still in your office." And
I've kept my office.
Good for you. Good for you.
I'm still using it.
Using it. That's good. That's a good term. Well, the learning about food systems, and that's one thing, because once we learn, then we can try to do something about the problems that exist within them, and that brings in the field of sociology, obviously, and food advocacy. And you had a question one time, I think, or you wrote about it in your book, about does food advocacy constitute a social movement? Wow. Now, I don't think you even have to pretend to ask that question, because you know it does. And what are some of the biggest issues that you feel you've taken on? Was it soda? Was it the the diet with the less meat? What do you think was the biggest issue?
You mean me personally?
Because you being the leader in food advocacy, especially with, you know, big industry, food industry.
I've taught courses in food advocacy, and I was appointed to as a sort of courtesy appointment in the sociology department because I hadn't realized it, but I had been practicing sociology without a license. And we taught a food movement course in the sociology department. And that was the question that the class was arguing about. I think it's something we still argue about because there are thousands and thousands, literally, of organizations that are working on food issues of one kind or another to try to change the food system to one that is healthier for people, for food workers, for animals, and for food animals, and for the planet. But these groups are not united, and they don't collectively form a force that has much in the way of political clout. And what you're trying to do as a social movement is to get some political traction so you can make real change. And so what confronts the food movement, if you want to call it that, is how do you get the power to get to make real change, even in the area of hunger, which is the one that has the most traction right now.
Right.
And to try to do something to get federal policy set up so that we eliminate hunger and food insecurity in the United States. That's the clear goal, or at least get it down to such a small percentage that it becomes a lot easier to deal with. And I think we still have a long way to go on even that one, let alone taking on chronic disease and weight-related chronic diseases, which now affect 3/4 of American adults are considered by the CDC to be overweight or obese. Mm. Obesity has become normalized in our society.
That's right.
Especially among children. And there's very little in the way of federal policy that's addressing that. So the question from an advocacy point of view is how do you take that on? And of course, I think I do it in my fashion. I do it through the books I write, Soda Politics, which is essentially an advocacy manual for taking on the soda industry. It's a very big book, and it has case study after case study after case study about how you try to get people to consume fewer soft drinks and less sugar-sweetened beverages because they're so obviously bad for health. And of course, we've seen a decline in consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages, in our country at least. And so that's a win in a way,
right.
Although the calories have been made up for in other ways.
Yes.
But it's a clear win. And then another of my books, Unsavory Truth, is about how the food industry sponsors food and nutrition research, which somehow, by the most amazing coincidence, almost invariably comes out with results that they can use in marketing. What a surprise.
Yeah, right. Well, it's the first thing you do when you read, I mean, me or anyone who's, you know, I guess been trained to read these reports, is that you go to the bottom line first before you read the study and say, well, who sponsored this? You
know, who paid for this?
Yeah, right. And, you know, and no wonder.
Yeah, I mean, if I see a paper that says, for example, sugars really aren't bad for health, they're really okay. That's my first question: is okay, who paid for this one? Bingo.
Right.
Invariably sponsored by the Sugar Association or people who take money from the Sugar Association or something like that. I mean, it's not a one-on-one. There are, in fact, studies that are sponsored by food companies that don't come out with results that are favorable, but they're few and far between, and they're much harder to find.
Yeah, and they're companies who do take a responsible role, and are, I think before they even sponsored it, probably are ready to retool their product. But it's interesting. It's just makes people aware, just like your students looking to see who the control group was. When there was a group of prisoners with two escapees. I mean, you know, you got to read these things and find out what, you know, don't believe everything is true that you read, right? I would like to move on to something that is very near and dear to me, and that's, again, you've mentioned the food studies department at NYU, but your career took you in a lot of places, mostly California, and then you were at Brandeis, and then in Washington, D.C., of course. But suddenly you were back in New York City. I say back because your early life was there. You were born there. But it seemed like getting back to New York City, and as well as mostly getting the appointment at NYU, was somehow written in your future all along. Tell me about establishing the food studies department. We know that it wasn't the food studies department when you arrived. Just give us a little quick background on that.
Well, I came to NYU to chair a department of home economics. I was kind of astounded. I didn't even think home economics still existed at the university level. And yet here was an ancient department that had been around for a long time. It was still called home economics. It was probably the most neglected department I had ever come across because the previous chair, the faculty weren't very well paid, the physical facilities were kind of horrible. Everybody seemed very complacent about what was going on, and I had been brought in by the administration to change it and to move it not into the 20th century, then please, the 21st century. And I came at a time when NYU was going through a really major transition. The administration and the board of trustees had decided that it was time for NYU to become a Research One university, to become a first-class institution, and they were willing to put the resources into it to try to make it a really important, impressive university that would be very desirable, not just for local New York residents, but from people all over the country. They were building new dormitories. They were setting it up to make it a truly international institution. It was a very, very exciting time to arrive at NYU in 1988, which was the year that I came. But I just didn't know how it would work. I was confronted with a department with faculty who seemed pretty, if they weren't complacent, they didn't seem nearly upset about their situation as I thought they ought to be. I thought they ought to be absolutely outraged at the condition of the department in which they were working and the neglect of the facilities. And, you know, I tell the story of my first week at NYU when the faculty were all off at a meeting of the American Dietetic Association, and I was left to my own devices, and I went around and started get acquainted visits with people that I thought I ought to meet. I didn't know anybody in New York. And my meetings all went the same way. People would say, oh, we're so glad you're here. The department really needs you. It's just great that you're here. I hate to bring this up because you only just got here, but there's something I've just got to say. And okay, shoot. And what they had to say was, your kitchen is dirty. Well, I was completely floored. Here I had a doctorate in molecular biology and a master's in public health and nutrition, and I had just been working in Washington as senior nutrition advisor to the Department of Health and Human Services, and I'd come to NYU and was confronted with a dirty kitchen? Excuse me? So the third time I heard this, the third time in a row I heard this, I thought, well, I have to go take a look. So the kitchen was in another building. I got off the elevator. I could smell it. I walked into the kitchen, and let me tell you, dirty did not describe what I saw. For one thing, there was all of the counters were greasy, and there was ample evidence everywhere of abundant wildlife. Is the only way I can
describe
it.
Wildlife is kind.
Wildlife. I thought, oh, this is interesting. And that was what I was confronted with, was a kitchen that was so neglected that nobody seemed to be responsible for keeping it in a state of cleanliness that was acceptable, even though it was old. It was a 20 or 30 year old home economics kitchen that clearly needed a lot of work, but mostly it needed a cleaning. And, you know, I tell the story about how the kitchen was, well, the kitchen was green. It was this avocado green color that was very popular in the 1950s. And I thought, well, okay, I can understand that. And then after it was steam cleaned, I walked into it and I couldn't believe it. The kitchen was blue.
That's a lot of dirt and grease.
That was a lot of dirt and grease. So that was what I was up against. It was really starting from scratch. And then, you know, I worked with the faculty, and we gradually were able to eliminate the home economics programs, which didn't have any students in them anyway. And then we had a hotel program where we were teaching hotel management without a license, which put us in an extremely vulnerable position. And when the university wanted to transfer the hotel program to the School of Continuing Education, we were left with a loss of $1 million a year in tuition revenue, which put us in a terrible, terrible position. And when the dean asked, what are you going to do to replace it? I said, food studies. There it was. I was ready. I had been hanging around with Old Ways Preservation and Exchange Trust, which was a group that brought food writers, academics, and chefs together around issues having to do with sustainability and healthy diets and other kinds of good things. And I knew that there was a real interest in food history and food and culture. A food consultant, Clark Wolf, was advising me and had put together an advisory committee that said we should food up our department. We weren't teaching enough about food. I was ready when the dean said that. And of course, her next question was, what's that? and we were off and running. But I mean, in part because the department was in such a vulnerable state, the food studies programs, undergraduate, master's, and doctoral, went through all of the necessary approvals in very short order. And Clark Wolf knew Marion Burroughs, who was writing for the New York Times food section at the time, told her about the program, and she wrote about it in the Times the week after the programs were approved by the state. And we had people in our office that afternoon holding the clipping and saying, we've waited all our lives for this program.
Yeah, and it's
and
no surprise.
So we had a class in the fall. We had a class right away.
That fall.
Thank you,
wow.
New York Times.
Wow. Well, you know, power of the press, as you said, yeah.
The power
for sure.
of the press, right. Absolutely.
Well, for listeners out there who maybe, you know, have been born after that period of time, to know the dearth of opportunity for anyone who wanted to study serious food issues, this was revelatory, and you really set the stage. And as you say, after that, you know, within the past 25 years, it's just been nonstop, the number of university programs that have not necessarily followed your lead, but taken their own lead, because everyone, you know, is realizing, but you helped get the word out there, and that, you know, these programs were necessary and needed. And what a difference it has made.
Well, I like to think that we made it academically respectable.
Right.
And the example that I give, well, I have two examples. One is doctoral students. We told our doctoral students they could get degrees in food studies, but they should understand that they would never get jobs at academic institutions because academic institutions are very siloed. And if you don't have a degree in history, you don't get a job in a history department. Mm-hmm. Never have I been happier about being so wrong in my life. All of our doctoral graduates who wanted academic positions have them. We even have a doctoral graduate who is at an Ivy League institution. One of our graduates is at Yale in a tenure-track academic position. So I was wrong about that completely. The other example I like to use is that we ran a seminar series for a while where we had anthropology graduate students who would come from universities all over the Northeast, because nobody in their department would advise them about how to write dissertations about food topics. And now anthropology departments everywhere are encouraging their students to write about food.
Right.
It's really changed.
Yes, indeed.
And that's very exciting and very gratifying. And I'd love to think that I had something to do with that.
Well, you undoubtedly did. And I think I'm going to, take a stab here at one of the reasons, aside from the quality of the people and the education you were giving. You have never been timid about the media. Here you are on a podcast, right? And you've been on radio, television, you've given the equivalent of TED Talks. Did you give a TED Talk? You gave some other kind of, what'd you give, a Nobel Talk, yes, right?
I was asked to speak at a couple of Nobel Prize symposiums, but...
Right.
No TED Talks.
You've never been afraid of the media, never been afraid of the press, and encouraged the press to call you, but you've always been out there for the media to answer to interviews and... discussions, and I think that once again, power to the power of the press, and I think it served you well.
Well, and the media can reach far more people than I can ever reach, mm-hmm. and my experience with reporters who write about food is that they're really smart, mm-hmm. And they teach me things. They send me articles that I might not otherwise see. They ask me questions I might not otherwise be asked. I find out very quickly from them what people are interested in. And I want them to get their stories right. I'm really happy to be involved in shaping media stories. I tell the story in the book about my year-long experience working with Marion Burroughs about the stories that she wrote about the withdrawal of the Department of Agriculture's Eating Right Pyramid
right.
in 1991 and 1992, when I've never had so much fun talking to reporters. It was just, I was a conduit of information to reporters, and as a result, I got quoted in a large number of stories and had an enormous amount of fun with that.
I'm so happy that you wrote this memoir and that you put it all down in writing. And I encourage people to take a look at it and read it. You'll get all these and more stories. There are so many good stories in it. And, it takes from the beginning of you growing up and then some of the struggles you faced into a very incredible career that many of us can identify with and applaud and thank you for, because you've made a difference in my life. I know you've made a difference in many people's lives and in the health of the United States and the rest of the world, we hope, as well. Again, the memoir is called Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics by Marion Nessel. Marion, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you.
All right, and thank you for listening. This has been, again, another Taste of the Past.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.